Today's program is brought to you by MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Hi, this is Celia Kutcher, host of Animal Instinct, and you are listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
And welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel. Here today with John Fraser, who, by the way, I am fascinated about the latter things we're going to talk about, marathon and Muay Thai. But before, we're going to talk about the food stuff. We're going to talk about how you are operating some of the most interesting, fantastic, and tasty vegetarian restaurants in New York. I air-quoted vegetarian because I don't know. There's this connotation sometimes with vegetarian that, you know, you don't know how to cook other things outside of that. But your pedigree, your repertoire is wonderful and immaculate. So let's start at that.
Thank you.
Being a California boy going through anthropology and understanding kind of the
what do you have on that paper?
Oh, you don't want to know. I got people in the CIA. Wow. I don't mean Culinary Institute.
What's my shoe size?
I look like a 9.5 to 10. Oh, 10.5. I'm not good with those visual cues. Right. I got my notes right here. But, you know, growing up in California, which has its own kind of cuisine, and then, you know, going to school for anthropology and studying what, you know, things mean, the deeper understanding of how things came to be. Where did your appreciation for food come from?
I thought we were just going to talk about potato fry bread.
We can definitely talk about it too.
Okay. I'm gonna have to turn my brain on for this one is what you're saying.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's try. I'm fascinated with the way people organize themselves and kind of the things that pop out when they do. And restaurants, in their best cases, they are little cultures, little microcosms, little organisms. They live and breathe, and they're made up of people and ideas and rules and economics, just like a society is. And each one of my restaurants, and probably every restaurant, sitting in Roberta's for sure, is different. And I think that's kind of what keeps me going in the restaurant game. Food is obviously my passion. Food is the thing that gets me up, and that's my creative, that's my paint, so to speak. But I'm much more fascinated by the thing called restaurant, and then, you know, then the restaurant culture, which is sort of bigger than one restaurant, and then and that becomes really a reflection of where you are and how you eat, and those are the very basic human values. There should be a period in there somewhere in the start of another sentence. I'm sorry.
No, you know, it was wonderful because sometimes I interject and I go like, I shouldn't have said something because that was a sound clip I wanted in its totality, right, of you kind of explaining that in a way that one of my favorite photographers was this guy, August Sander, and it was an anthropological study of workers, almost in the way that like Studs Terkel did that with, you know, public radio, right, in Chicago. But it sounds to me like you know everybody's role and how they interact with each other's role within that restaurant. And that's kind of what excites you about being in the restaurant world.
Yeah. And that you can plan almost everything and it never goes right. just like humans. Right.
Yeah.
I mean, I've said this many times, but you know, when I'm listening, you know, everyone is now, sort of has a gene of judgment, in restaurants. We've been programmed to you know, we hear everyone judging each other's food, and you know, you watch the television show where there's a judge, and so you kind of think that that's what you're supposed to do when you're inside of a restaurant, is become one of those judges. Like, I was fed, now it's time for me to judge. And when people are complaining about, you know, too much salt, or, you know, it should have been a little hotter, and I just start to think about, you know, how messy human beings are and how, you know, completely stupid we are at our base level. And you know, there is a human that planted the seed in the soil. There's a human that picked it. There's a human that packed it. There's a human that delivered it. There's a human that unpacked it all the way down the line, seasoned it, cooked it, brought it to your table. It's a miracle that it's not a complete disaster, because it's a bunch of humans that had to go along that chain. And at, you know, at our best, we're not very good.
Yeah. But you are very good. I mean, let's go back to a 2-year period where you spent time at the French Laundry in Yountville. And saw that brigade system within the kitchen, but also saw those extensions of, you know, from farm to table, as oft used as that phrase, you know. But, I mean, was that your first experience of seeing that complete microcosm?
Yeah. Well, I would say it's my best. It wasn't my first necessarily. I had some experience in Los Angeles and elsewhere, but that was the one that kind of clicked in the education, the college education, and whatever excitement that is to kind of watch the motor run, the motor run of a restaurant, and the creative, the output. And really, there was another piece of this, which is my parents were super blue collar and hard workers. And we worked so hard there, and that was, it all fell into place there. And that's when it started to bring a bunch of things together, and it made sense. And Thomas at that time was in the kitchen, and you know, we worked next to one another all day. And I think that, you know, when you're able to touch and feel that level of excellence and passion, you know, even if you try not to, it rubs off on you.
Yeah, I mean, you get to consider him a mentor, which is a wonderful thing. But what does a good mentor do? What do they mean to their mentee? And then also, how do you become a good mentor?
Right. I'm not positive I'm a very good mentor. It's something I'd like to work on. I don't know. I think possibly the simplest way to put it is leading by example. So whatever you would ask one to do, you would be willing to do for yourself. Do yourself, rather, excuse me. But you know, I think that taking risks and caring about people is maybe the simplest part, but also the thing that I really loved about Thomas is that he pushed us so hard, and he brought us to levels that we didn't know we had. And when you're able to realize a new level inside of yourself, then you're able to expect that of other people. So
after French Laundry, you push yourself even further, you know, overseas and cooked in Paris at, what was it, Taliban? And Maison
Blanche, and then Arpège just for a bit.
Yeah. And but what did those kitchens do for you?
Right. Well, I mean, I would start a little bit wider than that and say, Paris did something to me. Understanding, you know, we had this sort of, well, at the time, this was years ago, there was this fake connection between food and culture. It wasn't quite as solid as it is now, at least it wasn't in my eyes. And in Paris, it's a very, very solid connection, food and culture. Markets and sort of center markets and things like that were really important for me to see. But it was one of the most challenging things. I was illegal. So I was having to scrap it together. I was probably one of the better cooks in all the kitchens just because of my experience, but I didn't speak the language. So, there were some fun moments, you know, a mushroom was supposed to be in the window and a door rod was instead, that kind of stuff. So trial by fire. But I think it was really just about proving to myself that taking a risk was the right thing, which sort of segues into what landed me in New York.
Yeah.
I had nothing, and that was the risk. So I'm very comfortable in that uncomfortable spot, I would say.
Yeah. Are you comfortable now in New York after having been here for how many years now?
I think I'm at 15.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think I'm comfortable. I don't understand it, but I'm really comfortable. I think I've experienced less of New York than most people who've been here for 15 years, because most of the time I've been in a kitchen. But I certainly respect my place and appreciate what the city's offered me.
I mean, we appreciate what you've offered this city, especially recently. Nick's, I mean, first of all, I want to know where that name comes from.
Yeah.
But secondly, I want to know where that inspiration came from. I know you've been leading kind of a vegetarian diet for about 5 years now, but why is Nix so important to you now?
Right. So about 5 years ago, I started to make changes personally in my diet. It wasn't an all of a sudden cold turkey thing. It was slow, and honestly, to call me a vegetarian now is incorrect. I still taste food at the restaurants. I'm looking at a pizza with meat on top of it. I'm not going to eat it, right? So I do it for work. Rather, I eat meat for work. On Thanksgiving, I had a little slice of turkey, and it was delicious. But it's not in my everyday. I'm probably 99.9% a vegetarian. So we started on this journey around the same time that I became personally a vegetarian. I at the same time, did this thing called Meatless Mondays, not having known that there was this brand called Meatless Mondays. It was quite serendipitous, but, on Mondays at Dovetail, And I did it because it's slow in the summers at Dovetail uptown during the week. Everyone's out of town. And so I did it as sort of to exercise a creative muscle. And we did this vegetarian thing, and lo and behold, we were reaching people that we'd never reached before. People who want to have a fine vegetarian experience, but don't really have the option in New York City. Most of the vegetarian here, it's not about dining, it's about eating, when you can kind of understand the difference between those two things. And all of a sudden, Monday became our third busiest day after Friday and Saturday. So commercially and creatively, things started to line up, and I started to think about, you know, what would happen if we did a vegetarian restaurant. So I started looking about 6 months later, and it took me 5 years to find the spot. I wanted it to be near Union Square, which is essentially the closest quote unquote farm in New York City. And I wanted to do it with a little bit more weight. So I had to do another weight. W-E-I-G-H-T,
yeah.
Right. I had to do another project to make sure that it wasn't just some outlier from the Upper West Side. And it also allowed us to kind of hone in on what that version of that restaurant would be. I would say that a year after I found a space about a year after we started doing the Monday thing. And I think that if we had opened that restaurant, it would have been a lot more fancy, and it probably wouldn't have gone as well as it's going. I don't think that people were ready for it, and I also don't think that I would have been so sort of loosey with it. The food is very loose, and it's very fun and casual, which is, I think, the perfect entry point for the populace. So I'm glad it took me this long, but it did happen.
Yeah.
And through every place, I mean, Dovetail has, I don't know, maybe 18 dishes on the menu, of which 6 are vegetarian. Narcissa has, I don't know, a few vegetarian entrees, and these are some of the best press and most ordered dishes. So the proof is in the pudding in terms of, was it a good idea or how much of a risk was it? I don't really think it was that much of a risk, because I have the results in my reports that say that people want to eat vegetables.
It was more risk management than risk itself.
Totally. And,
yeah.
And I think that timing is very important. There was this pendulum swinging, when we started doing the vegetarian Mondays, that it was pork and whole pigs and, pig tattoos and the whole thing. Right. And it took a while for the pendulum to swing the other way. And I think that we're finally sort of heading towards, something that's about health and wellness and paying attention to how what you eat affects your body and your brain and your relationship with the future.
Well, I'm glad you did take that risk, because without it, we wouldn't have carrots Wellington. And we wouldn't have potato fry bread. We wouldn't have buffalo fried cauliflower. We're going to take a quick break and come back and talk more to John Fraser about the new age of vegetarian cuisine here in New York City. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org.
Hi, this is Peter Kim, the executive director of MOFAD, the Museum of Food and Drink. We're a nonprofit founded by Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues here on the Heritage Radio Network, and we want to take people on a learning adventure through the world of food. We just opened MOFAD Lab, our gallery space at 62 Bayard Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn, where we are currently showing Flavor, Making It and Faking It. Flavor features some very cool sensory interaction. Flavor tablets deliver tastings of vanilla and umami, and the Willy Wonka-inspired smell synth lets you compose over 500,000 different flavors. So come on by and visit MoFad Lab. We're open 5 days a week, and tickets are $5 for kids and $10 for adults. Learn more about the Museum of Food and Drink at MoFad.org.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell, here with John Fraser of Dovetail, Narcissa, Nyx. And right before the break, I mentioned Carrots Wellington. And for those of you that don't know what that is, based off of beef Wellington. Buffalo fried cauliflower, based off of, buffalo fried chicken wings. What I find fascinating about these things is that, yes, they are now vegetarian appetizers and entrees, but they are derivative of, a meat dish. Do you think that's an important kind of line, a thread to follow when introducing, vegetarian dishes to somebody, that there has to be a basis of it from once being a meat dish or having those flavor profiles?
So I'll say two things about that. So the first is that I think that when things are new, people like to be pulled along slowly. And the way that they can be pulled along is by having an understanding of something and not having it be a completely new concept. With Nyx, we're in a conversation with the public, unlike one that I've seen before. I would imagine that sushi restaurants at one point had it with the public. I would imagine that. Trying to think of another type of recent cuisine entry into New York City.
I feel like Mexican cuisine right now.
Yeah, to a lesser extent, but yeah, that's fine, right? So, which is that, when you do something that's new and that people don't have a remembrance from their childhood of, and they're sort of pre-programmed to like or not like, it's very interesting to watch their reaction to the food. So I think that, so let me answer your question first. Sorry. those are just names, right? It's carrots wrapped in puff pastry. It's fried cauliflower with sauce on top of it. Those are just names that help people understand that, oh, we've seen this before. It might be delicious. It's just different, right? But the kind of war that we're waging in terms of being new and a new style of cuisine, and by no means am I saying I made up vegetarian food, but what I am saying is that most people think that vegetarian restaurants and vegetarian food means health food. Most people think that vegetarian restaurants mean alfalfa sprouts and yoga, and it does to a certain extent. I like yoga and alfalfa sprouts, but I still have a belly, and there's a reason for that, because I eat fried food and I eat shit that's bad for me. It just happens to be vegetables.
Well, let me stop you there for a second. Bad for you maybe calorically, but
calorically,
but
yeah.
Good for you when it comes to satiating.
Okay. Yeah, yeah. Right. And I'll, yeah, I mean, we can go down that road of satiation, yeah. and the idea that, something doesn't have to die for you to enjoy it, right? But that's kind of a different conversation and maybe one that we should table for now. sponsored by Fairway Meat.
Yeah.
I think that we're just having a conversation with the public, and that needs to be in a language that they understand, and so those tags, those sort of carrot Wellingtons and others, they're just ways to bring people in and ease them into a different style of eating, and I think the part that's kind of surprising is that defining vegetarian food as something that is withholding from calories or withholding from flavor is incorrect. And that's the conversation we're trying to have now. How can we convince people that they're not on a diet when they're eating vegetables?
They're not on a flavor diet either. I mean, as you just said,
right.
How impactful. What's so amazing to me is when I think about, vegetables versus meat, meat, I kind of explain as an underlying flavor of the animal itself. But vegetables, like a carrot is a carrot. Mm-hmm. Like, what a carrot tastes like, and you can dial that up. You can amplify it. You can change that. But when you have a steak is a steak. Mm-hmm. Like, it's all the things that you marinate the steak in, the sauce. But I don't know. I just feel like some of these core vegetables have so much more latitude than you know, the proteins that we come to expect.
Absolutely. Yep.
And you are doing that at Nick's, being able to express those things. And then you take something so simple, like the potato, and turn it into a fry bread, I mean, of Eastern European origin, I assume.
Yep.
And it's become a revelation to many. Why do you think that is?
I mean, it's just a different way to sin. It's a different way it's a different way to have a French fry, simply put. And I just, you know, the way that that dish came to be is I saw it in a book. I've heard of it before. I've never had it before. So we decided to figure out what our version of that would be. I would like to think that our potato fry bread is the most potato-y fry bread there is. Our goal was to make it about the vegetable and the tuber, not about the bread. And then top it with familiar ingredients like sour cream and cheese and radishes. And again, there is some playing going on. And I think that, you know, creativity is at its best just play.
Mm-hmm.
And hopefully that comes across on the plate. But it also hopefully makes you feel like you got the got your money's worth, and that your palate is gone somewhere it's never been before, and the room is nice and lively, and there's good music, and you know, and then the whole thing gets put together. Because I don't just think it's about the potato fry bread. I think it's about, you know, the sexiness in the space and the way that the engagement of the staff is with the guest and how you feel when you leave, right? I mean, as a chef, I'm of course always focused on the food, but I certainly don't think that that's all that matters.
The tandoor. Mm-hmm. I always wonder when you hear about a piece of equipment that's getting press, whether or not the restaurant was built around that mm-hmm. being a focal point,
yeah.
or it just happened to be there. I mean, in which case was it for Nick's?
Right. So, you know, in the original thing, we knew we wanted to have a very hot oven. I wasn't sure if it was a tandoor or an upright. And the restaurant that we took over was an Indian restaurant. So there happened to be two tandoor ovens, which we subsequently switched out because they were old and cracked up. But, yeah, so, you know, it's kind of like, you know, being given a gift of decision, right? It was either going to be an upright sort of brick guy or a tandoor, and it was sort of decided for us that's what it was going to be. So this thing is a sort of clay wrapped fire pit that you pop your hand into and push bread onto the edge of. And it's about 700 to 800 degrees, and the bread happens very, very quickly. So there's like a nice even char on the outside, and then the sort of the crispy, crunchy burnt ends that give it a little bit of texture and personality.
Yeah, but are you making Indian food out of that tandoor?
Mm-mm.
That's always the fascinating thing. I mean, because you use flavors of Mexico in some of your things.
Yep.
You use, you know, the potato fry bread is Eastern Bloc Europe, and then you have this tandoor, and there's an expectation to some people that hear equipment and relate it to cuisine.
Yeah.
But you're making, you know, Middle Eastern dips to go with this.
Yeah, I would be very careful not to define any of the things that we're doing as authentic. I think that, you know, I'm not trying to, we don't even call it naan. It's called tandoor bread because
yeah.
it's nothing like naan. And in addition, the dips are sort of maybe from that area of the world because dippy things happen over there. But it's certainly not. We're not trying to say that this is Meliziano Salata from Greece. It's our version of an eggplant dip.
Yeah. But what it is inevitably delicious. And I feel like if anyone hasn't gone to Nick's, they're in for a surprise, which is both good and sad. You know, like, it shouldn't be a surprise that vegetables can be this delicious. But it is a surprise to see such skill and thoughtfulness behind, you know, the menu itself. And
thank you.
That's an ode to everything you've done in the past.
Thank you.
So it's just a really great time in New York to kind of champion this kind of eating and kind of microcosm that is a restaurant.
Yeah, we're really, you know, we didn't make it up. I think that there's some kind of, like I said, pendulum swinging, and there's something about the right now that is right for vegetables, whether it be the way that people see their own bodies or what's important to them. But ultimately my goal is to create a category. So it's not about, you know, taking a night off and having vegetables. Differently, you wake up and say, what do you want to eat tonight, honey? Mexican, Italian, or vegetarian? That it's creating a category. It's actually an option, and it's not an option where you feel like you're being let down, but an option you run towards. And I think that, you know, having other great chefs in the same category will help us out a lot. And I hearken back to sort of, I use sushi as an example a lot. You know, if, you know, you were to say to my father when he was my age, you know, people eat sushi raw fish one day a week. He would, no way. It's impossible. Raw fish is gross, right? It's because he didn't grow up eating it. He didn't understand that there was some virtue to it, and that it's really, it really can be made delicious. And I think we're in that sort of baby steps for vegetarianism now.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about Muay Thai and marathoning another time. We have a lot more discussions, and we'll just do that by the tandoor. Thank you, John, for being on The Food Scene. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkill. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on HeritageRadioNetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at Heritage_Radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@HeritageRadioNetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.